welcome to the Life of Peter class. I'm looking forward to this class. Jack and I have been talking about it a lot, and I think we're going to have some good discussion and hopefully make some good applications for us. I was going to break us up into groups and have us talk about a question, but I can't break us into groups, so we'll just have to do it as a class. But I want us I'd like to hear your answers for this question. What do you hope to gain from this study? A longer way of asking that is here in the smaller text, which is, how can reconstructing the life and personality of Peter help us in our spiritual growth? But if you prefer to answer what do you hope to gain from this study, that's fine too. That maybe is more personal and easier to come up with. So what do you think?
Well, Mason, I'll say that, you know, we give a lot of attention to Paul in the New Testament, and deservedly so, maybe, because he's written so many of the letters, and we see him a lot in the Book of Acts. But it's for me personally, just want to learn a little bit more about Peter and how he fits into the whole, the whole mission, if you will, of the Great Commission.
Yeah, excellent. I mean, if you had never read Acts before and you started reading the book, you'd think Peter was the main character, right? Because he is for like the first, 11 chapters. And then all of a sudden this Saul guy appears, and he's a bad guy at first. And then suddenly he's like the hero of the book. It's like Luke lost the plot or something. So, yeah, what's that about? What's Peter's role? And how does how do his experiences factor into the our understanding of the New Testament? Good. What else?
Mason, I think context matters. So just knowing the context of stuff is helpful in figuring out why this stuff is important and why it matters and the meaning behind it. So.
Yeah. So you can correct me if I'm misunderstanding you, but it sounds like you're saying, given that he's a character in the New Testament, almost regardless of how important he turns out to be, it's important for us to understand what he's doing, what he's thinking, what his experiences are, in order to understand the text as it's given to us.
Yeah.
Is that fair? Okay. Yeah, I think that's right. Fortunately, we have more about Peter than we do about some of the other characters in the New Testament, so we have a little bit more material to work with. But yeah, that's an excellent point. Anything else?
Hey, Mason, Blaine here.
Oh, guys, I see a hand up. Okay, go ahead, Blaine.
Oh, it's okay. Sorry. Peter's one of those Bible characters that has some attributes and characteristics that could be viewed in a negative way, right? He's outspoken, he's headstrong, but God ends up using him for a very positive way in the kingdom. And I think about myself and my own attributes. I know I've got some that are good, but I've got some that are not good. And it's very interesting to me that God found a way to use Peter, even some of the things that on the surface might not look as, to be positive attributes, they were actually used for good. And I think there's a lesson for that in all of us.
Yep. Excellent. So we'll be looking for those kinds of lessons to learn. Dad?
I think we're invited to look at the followers of Jesus. Hebrews 13 comes to mind. Consider those who have the rule over you, consider the outcome of their faith. And even Peter is mentioned in 1 Corinthians 15 among the many witnesses of the resurrection. So the change brought about in his life and the lives of many others, of course, is a source of encouragement and an example of faith to us, and perhaps even an evidence, of the resurrection, the basis of our faith as well.
So. Yep. Excellent. You guys have been giving really specific things, which is good. Jack and I, because we had to kind of come up with things that would take 13 lessons to develop instead of just one, sermon or a short talk or something. Here's what we came up with, a little bit broader. We want to understand the scope and the source of Peter's character transformation. This is some of the things that we've already talked about. Where did that change come from? Why did it happen? Who was responsible for it? We want to imitate Peter's growth in Christ-like character. The change that Blaine talked about. And we want to prepare to defend a scriptural view of Peter's role and authority in the early church. We'll come back to this in lots of the lessons, but it's not a surprise to anybody here that there are gross misconceptions about Peter's role in the early church. But unfortunately, there are also reactions to those gross misconceptions that are themselves misunderstandings, I think, of what the text tells us about Peter and his role and authority in the early church. So we want to try to find the scriptural view, understand it, and be able to defend it as a part of a defense of our faith, which, not coincidentally, Peter is the one who tells us we ought to be prepared to give. But I want to just say to start that this class is a little bit different from other Bible classes that that we sometimes teach. We're going to be looking at the text of the scriptures in a little bit different way than usual. If you think about it, the New Testament and even the Gospels, that's not a biography of anybody. It's not even really a biography of Jesus, right? The Gospel writers are very clear that they are writing not so that we will know everything Jesus did or what his motivations were or who his best friend was, but so that we would be able to believe, so that we would lose this, so that we would know for certain that the things that we have believed are true. And so, you know, to read the text for biographical information, especially for somebody who isn't Jesus, I was telling somebody this weekend, it's kind of like taking the text and turning it sideways a little bit and looking through it at a different angle. It's not the point, but there is information there for us to find. And so as we're going through the stories about, or stories from the New Testament in which Peter is a character, even when he's the main character, we won't necessarily discuss the main point of a particular passage. And so I hope that doesn't make anybody upset that we don't go into detail about the various stories about Peter. We're looking at his character development, which, as I say, is not necessarily the main point of the text. Excuse me, I'm wrestling with my single screen view here. We want to focus on application, though, not just information. It's easy to get caught up in the details about Peter's life, and especially easy to get caught up in the details that were hinted at but not actually described. And we want to kind of do what Paul advises Timothy to do, which is to avoid myths and endless genealogies. And there are lots of traditions and maybe myths about Peter and his life, and we want to try to steer clear of those. Some of you pointed out in the introductory exercise, the characters in the Bible are given for our growth and learning. I didn't put Hebrews 13 on here, but Paul is clear in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 11, and Romans 15, verse 4, that those who have come before us, whose stories are recorded, are there so that we will learn to imitate their faith and avoid their mistakes. And knowing these men and women better gives us better insight into our own spiritual condition. And so we want to focus on application, find out how we, as Blaine said, are already like Peter, maybe in good ways, maybe in bad ways, and then how we can learn to grow like Peter grew and overcome our natures to sin. And in any biographical study from the Bible, our aim ought to be to do the other part of what Paul tells Timothy in 1 Timothy 1, 4 and 4, 7, which is furthering the administration of God, which is by faith, and disciplining ourselves for the purpose of godliness. To know more about God, ultimately, to deepen our faith in him, and to be more faithful and godly in our lives. So, based on this approach, Jack and I have outlined some key themes that we want to focus on in Peter's life. And I think if we kind of keep coming back to these themes, it makes it easier to organize the applications that we want to make. So the three themes that we will be focusing on are, first, Peter's struggle between enthusiasm for Christ and the kingdom and being misled by that enthusiasm. And we'll talk about those occasions where Peter gets really fired up about Jesus and about making the kingdom happen in the way he thinks it's going to, and he goes too far and he makes a mistake. I wonder, it's hard to know when you read 1st and 2nd Peter what Peter's, if he's thinking about his own experiences or if he's just saying, like, look, this is the truth. He says, I'm going to remind you of these things that you know are true. But he does, it's interesting that in 1 Peter 1:13, he tells us to gird up the loins of our minds, to be sober, to set our hope perfectly on the grace that is to be revealed, to focus on the truth, and think soberly about it, which, if you think about it, is kind of the opposite of what Peter does in a lot of the gospel stories. And so I think looking at Peter's example can help us move toward that mindset that he describes in 1 Peter 1:13. The second theme is that Peter's character transformation is centered in the death and resurrection of Christ. That's fairly self-evident. But it's important for us to remember that Peter didn't pull himself up by his own bootstraps, that the cross and his experience with it and his experience with Christ are the center of his character transformation. And so his life is an example for us of how to be holy ourselves also in all of our behavior, knowing that, just like Peter, we were redeemed with the precious blood of Christ. And so we want to look to him for an example in that. And finally, we want to think about applications surrounding Peter's role in the church as it's defined by the New Testament. Peter, whatever view you take of Peter, even if you take the Catholic view that he was the first pope, he's still part of the foundation, as Paul describes it in Ephesians 2:20, on which we, as living stones, are being built up as a spiritual house for a holy priesthood. Now, I'm not advocating that Peter was the first pope. I'm just saying, whatever view you take of him, he's a part of this foundation on which we are also being built as additional stones, as additional, well, Peters, really, in the Greek. So we want to kind of think of Peter's place and then our place as part of the same spiritual house that's being built. And find ways to change based on that. So in Peter, we find not only a model to follow, but also a source of motivation and encouragement because, as we've already observed, he makes a lot of mistakes, and he makes a lot of the same mistakes that I do. And that's encouraging to me to know that if he can come back and return and be faithful and useful in the kingdom, so can I. Okay, that's all introduction stuff to the class. Here's the schedule of lessons. This is in the material. I hope everybody got the material. It's on the website. If you didn't, you should be able to download it from the main page. And I hope you'll do the lessons. The material, I'll be honest, is adapted from some material that Brother Hall put together a few years ago. And I think it will do a good job of walking you through the text so you understand what's happening so that in class we can focus on the applications and themes that we've talked about. Okay, so the first lesson is meeting the Master, these very early interactions with Jesus. And I find them fascinating. And I'll also just say as we start that we are greatly indebted to the Gospel of John for this information because it's really only found there. And so that's why we're spending so much time in this first lesson in the beginning of the Gospel of John. Our objectives for today are to be able to explain how Peter met Jesus and found out who he was, to be able to name at least three events in Jesus' early public ministry that Peter witnessed, the foundation of Peter's faith, but also of his discipleship in a practical sense, and finally to be able to list at least three of Peter's relatives mentioned or named in the Gospels. That's not super critical for our faith, but it's always good to know Scripture better, so I put one kind of memory based on in the objectives. These are also not, I just realized, they're not in the order that we're going to go through them in the lesson, so if you're taking notes, I apologize for that. So this is another group exercise that we can't do because I'm not the host. So we'll just, if you just have an answer, shout it out. I only have one screen, so I can't see everybody, so if you raise your hand, I probably won't see you. So just unmute yourself and shout, and if we interrupt each other, that's fine. I'll separate anybody that starts fighting, digitally, of course. So let's just kind of brainstorm what we know about Peter. What was Peter's birth name? Hint, it's on the screen.
Simon.
Yeah, Simon. Good. Anybody else have an answer for that? Maybe depending on the translation you're using.
Well, it is called Cephas.
Yeah. But that's not his birth name. We'll get to that.
He's Ben Jonah or Bar Jonah.
Right. So let's, based on that, let's go to the next one. Who are his known family members? You know a little bit of Hebrew. You might know that Bar something means son of, and in fact, it's clear from some of the other accounts that his father's name actually was
Jonah
or John. Who are some other family members that we know of? They may not have names that are recorded, but who else do we know of?
Mother-in-law,
which therefore by implication means
he had a wife.
They had a wife, right? There's some other ways we can know that as well. Good. Anything else?
Andrew.
Yeah. Good. He had a brother named Andrew. There's one more. I'll surprise you with it in just a minute. What about his hometown? If you did the lesson and you read the first part of John, this was in chapter 1, I think.
Bethsaida.
Yeah, Bethsaida. Good. And we'll say a little bit about that in just a second. Good. His occupation, I think just about everybody knows this one.
Fisherman.
Yeah, good. What about known friends and or business associates?
James and John.
Yeah, James and John, right. And we'll talk about that in just a second. There are some other ones that I think are hinted at that we'll explore in just a minute. And I'm going to save this attitude and obedience to the old law one for just a second, and we'll come back to it. So let's talk about some of these answers. So depending on the translation you're using, his birth name is given as either Simon or Simeon. That's significant because one is Greek and one is Aramaic. And what's significant about that is it means he was probably bilingual. If you or someone you know is bilingual, you know, you may have kind of two versions of the same name, right? One that is more easily pronounceable in one language, and one that is more easily pronounceable in another. Or you end up with a name that can be, if you name your kids and they're bilingual, you end up with a name that can be pronounced equally well in whichever language. So the fact that he has that probably indicates he was bilingual, which would turn out to be useful for his work later in the kingdom. Known family members, we've covered these, but you remember in 1 Peter chapter 5, Peter says, I exhort you as a fellow elder. Well, if you cross-reference the qualifications for elders in 1 Timothy or Titus, that suggests that Peter also had children, right? Now, we don't know how many, we don't know their names. We would presume, based on the qualifications, that they were faithful, godly people, but they're not even mentioned. It's only kind of by cross-referencing the qualifications that we infer that they exist. His hometown, correctly identified as Bethsaida, but if you read the text, particularly starting in the Synoptic Gospels, where does Peter live?
In Capernaum, at least his mother-in-law lives there, right?
Right. Well, he lives there, too. They go to Peter's house after they come from the synagogue. Remember when Jesus stands up and says this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing, they immediately go to Peter's house, and there Peter's mother-in-law is sick. So these towns, Bethsaida is actually, we're still not totally sure where it is, but just last year there was a really interesting archaeological excavation that presents better evidence to be Bethsaida than the previous site that everyone kind of thought might be it. So we're still sort of waiting for that to develop further. The excavation was shut down because of COVID. But anyway, either way, whichever site it is, they're within a couple of miles of each other. They're very close to where we are fairly confident Capernaum is. They're very close together, but they're on different sides of a border. And so one thought is that Peter and his family were from Bethsaida originally, but they moved to Capernaum because that's where they were selling all of their fish. And if they moved there, they didn't have to pay import duties at the tax booth when they brought their catch into shore. And do you remember somebody who worked at a tax booth on the way up from the water in Capernaum?
Matthew.
Yeah, Matthew did, right? So maybe Peter knew Matthew because he was like his local, you know, fishing license bureaucrat or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, anyway. So these two towns, though, their economies are pretty clearly based on fishing, based on both archaeological and etymological evidence. The name Bethsaida actually means house of the fishermen. And so that's fairly significant, seems to be, for what the main occupation was for people who lived there. All right. His occupation, he was a fisherman. I put it here that he co-owned a fishing enterprise. We want to be really careful when we're reading, trying to do this by kind of biographical study, that we don't impose our kind of modern ideas about economy and work and relationships onto these things. They wouldn't have thought of it as co-owning a fishing enterprise. They would have thought of it as working together to make a living, you know. But he had partners. He owned his boat. James and John had employees from Mark 1, verse 20. So if they were partners, it's presumable that Peter did as well. And if the house that is identified as Peter's in Capernaum, which is a tradition that goes back a long time, if that is Peter's house, its size and configuration may suggest that they were relatively successful by contemporaneous standards. It doesn't mean they were rich. You could think of them as kind of, you know, moderately successful sole proprietors of a business. They're making it. They're doing well for themselves. That's a little bit of speculation, but you know, he's. We'll see in John, when we get into John, that he has at least time to take off to go listen to John the Baptist. So he's not, you know, he's not living hand to mouth. All right. So the known friends and business associates, we talked about James and John. There's one way to read John chapter 1 is that because they were from the same town, that Peter and Andrew would have known Philip and Nathaniel. They're identified as being from the same town. These towns aren't tiny, but they're not huge. And so, and also, if you look at the end of John, they all go fishing together. Philip and Nathaniel and Peter and Andrew and James and John, they all go fishing together. Well, you don't go fishing with people who don't know what they're doing. They're a liability. They're a hazard in the boat where everybody's expected to pull their weight. So perhaps Philip and Nathaniel were fishermen as well. And as I say, you know, given Matthew's occupation and where he's located, according to the text, they may have known him as well. Don't want to get too much into speculation, but it seems possible. Okay, so this last one, obedience to the old law, obedience and attitude toward the old law. You had a chance to look at the lesson. What did you come up with for this one? What's Peter's attitude toward the old law? How was he at obeying it?
I went to Acts 10, and he said he'd never eaten anything clean or out of the law. Now, that may have been hyperbole, but he was praying at that time, and there were men that were sent to him to learn the gospel.
Yep. I agree, Ken. I think that is significant, and I tend to believe that it's not hyperbole. I think that Peter was probably conscientious enough that that's really the way he lived. The other perhaps significant passage in this regard is, you remember when some people came to Peter asking if Jesus paid the temple tax, and Peter's answer immediately was, well, of course he does. And then you had to go to Jesus and ask him about it, you know? I wonder if that indicates that, it was important to Peter to be seen to be obeying the law. And yet, very early in Jesus' ministry in Mark 7, he, along with the other disciples, are ready to reject the tradition of the Pharisees, particularly in regards to washing, right? So whatever Peter's attitude towards the law, he very early is already able to separate the traditions that the Pharisees have imposed from the sort of what we might call the core of the law. So I don't know what that means exactly. Maybe he's one of these non-traditional Jews or something, But that seems like it might be an important factor. And then finally, it seems like, we'll talk about this more on the next slide, but it seems like he's a disciple of John. He's down at Bethany, beyond the Jordan, listening to John. He's looking for the Messiah. And if he'd been listening to John, he would have heard John talk about the need for forgiveness of sins. He would not need have heard him talk about the kind of moral living that John describes in John in Luke chapter 3. When the people go out to him and listen, and he's telling them how to live. Peter would have heard all that. He apparently was interested enough to leave his job and travel all the way down to the other end of the Jordan River. Let's go ahead and look at that that passage in John 1. So here's Bethsaida. Capernaum is that one was on the map. Capernaum is right next to it on the other side of the Jordan River. Bethany beyond the Jordan is down here. It's probably a couple of days' journey. It is on the path from Galilee. You remember they would cross the river, come down this side, and then go up the Jericho Road to Jerusalem. It's on the path to Jerusalem, but it's still quite a ways from home. It's really not, the transportation is different for us, of course, but it's really not dissimilar to us, like, driving to, Utah or New Mexico for a gospel meeting or something like that. It's like a two-day drive, right? And it's kind of a two-day walk to get down there. But he did it. He went to hear John. He thought that was important. And so from hearing John, he would have been looking for the Messiah. And so you remember the story. John points Andrew to Jesus. Andrew finds Peter and brings him to Jesus. And from that, I just want to point out what a wonderful thing it is that both brothers were looking for the Messiah. In fact, they were so eager to find him that when Andrew heard from John that that's him, that guy right there, that's the Messiah, his first reaction is to go get his brother. Because he and all he has to say to him is, we found him. We found the Messiah, and Peter's on board. I just think that's wonderful. It's a challenge to me as a parent to try to raise my kids to have that kind of relationship, not only with God and his word, but with each other, that they will look out for each other's best spiritual interests. So Jesus immediately in John 1:42 renames Peter. He gives Simon the name Peter. So in Greek, that's Petros. In Aramaic, it's transliterated in our Bible as Cephas. Notice again that Peter ends up with a bilingual name, a name in each language, right? They mean the same thing. They both mean rock, but in different languages. So he could continue to, I guess, fish in two languages or something. But it's important to point out that this isn't a common name. It is now. Peter and Simon are both very common names in our world, largely because of the influence of Peter the Apostle. But in the day, that would not have been a common name. It is both in meaning and in sort of emotional impact and in terms of commonality. It'd be like calling him Rocky. It's a name we've kind of heard, mostly maybe because of a movie. But before that, like, it was not a common name. But it's a name that is evocative, and it captures an idea, an image that I think Jesus wanted to associate with Peter. And so Jesus calls all of these men. The next day he calls a couple of more, Philip and Nathaniel. And from here they go up to Cana to the wedding feast in John chapter 2. And it's about 5 days later, and they're all called disciples. I think that says a lot about the readiness of these men to receive the truth of God, that within 5 days they are being called disciples of Jesus. Now, obviously, they didn't know everything in 5 days. They didn't know everything by the time he died, but they are convinced enough of who he is based on John's testimony and their own experiences that they are called disciples. Now, I want to talk in a little bit more detail about Jesus changing Peter's name, but first I want to see if anybody has any questions or comments about anything that we've said. I've just sort of dumped a bunch of information on you, so I apologize for that. What what are your thoughts about any of this?
Nathan?
Yes.
I appreciate your thought about, on the business, their fishing business being, at least marginally successful. Because in my mind, I always think, they're just, scraping just to get by. We read the times when, they couldn't catch any fish and Jesus had to come and that kind of thing. So in my mind, I'm thinking, these guys, they're barely making it. So, yeah, when they follow Jesus, they've got nothing better to do, right? But to your point, if they do have a successful business, it kind of adds to the idea that they really had this love for Jesus and were willing to give up their whole livelihood to follow him. And to me, it speaks more to the great faith that they had in Jesus.
Yeah, and it makes Peter sound a little bit more petulant in Matthew chapter 19, verse 27, when he says, "Oh, look, we've left everything to follow you," right? I mean, yeah, like you say, he did leave something. And so it makes him sound maybe even a little whinier in that passage. But yeah, that's fair. I think he is being whiny in some ways. Anything else?
So regardless of him being maybe whiny or not, but you mentioned his readiness, and I think that's something that is pretty obvious with Peter. You mentioned it earlier, how enthusiastic, that's the word you use, that Peter is. And you can see that enthusiasm here and how ready he was to change his life and his daily life, physical daily life, in order to follow. And that's something I really admire in Peter, and I think you see it just in what you've painted here.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes people will point out that, like, Peter didn't even have to hear John say it was the Messiah. He just heard his brother say it in Hebrew. And I think that's fair. Again, I think that speaks to their relationship and their maybe family concern or interest for obedience to the scriptures. But, I think most of the credit has to go to Peter just being ready, looking for the Messiah based on the testimony of John. And presumably some knowledge of the Old Testament prophecies that said, it's coming, now's the time.
Right, and you see that in, like, the book of Luke, and other people were ready because of what the Old Testament said, and if Peter really is as attuned with the Old Testament as we've looked at this evening, I think that would make sense.
It certainly seems that way, yeah. Yeah, and some have pointed out that, when in Acts 4, when the council points out, like, these men are untrained and untutored. We sometimes read that as, like, they're total buffoons, like, they don't know anything. I'm not sure, first of all, I'm not sure we're obligated to believe the council's testimony about these men. Like, the council clearly had it in for them, right? So why should we accept their assessment of their education and skill? Obviously, the work of the Spirit is involved there, but still, like, I would not hesitate to say these men went to synagogue on a very regular basis. They understood the scriptures. They were looking out for the coming of the Messiah. They were interested in obedience to God, as evidenced by their discipleship to John the Baptist first and then to Jesus. And I think there's a very good argument to be made for their own, sincerity and even a measure of skill in the scriptures. Anything else? All right. Well, so, at this point in our study of Peter, the most significant thing that's happened to him is that Jesus changes his name. Apparently, this may have been the first time Jesus and Peter ever laid eyes on each other. And Jesus says, "Hey, guess what? You're Rocky." And everybody's like, "What? What do you mean? Like, where did that come from?" So let's explore this idea a little bit. Can you think of some other Bible figures who were renamed by God?
Abraham was the first one that came to my mind.
That's good, because he's the first one on my list.
who
else?
Jacob.
Sarah too. Jacob, yes, you're right. So Abraham and Sarah are their names are changed really in the same, like, subsequent verses. And then a few chapters later, Jacob's name is changed as well. And those three and Peter are really the only ones.
What about Saul's Bible?
Yeah, so he often shows up on lists like this. But if you, I mean, you're welcome to disagree with me, but when I read that account in Acts, is it 12 or 13? I can't remember the where it says Saul, who is called Paul, there's no indication that that name was given to him by God. And, it, you know, there's some indication that he may have chosen it for himself for reasons that are not fully revealed. So if you wanted to include him, I'm not going to argue with you, but in these four cases, it is God speaking directly to the person and saying, this used to be your name, but now this is your name. So we can argue later about whether Paul qualifies for the list.
Well, I'm not going to argue.
yeah. So Abraham's name change, I think, signifies God's intent to keep his promises. It's been a while since the original promises were made to Abraham back in Genesis 12. And God comes to him and says, here, I'll confirm that I'm going to keep the promise. I'm going to change your name from Exalted Father, which is a terrible name for somebody with no children, to Father of Multitudes, which shows I'm going to make you a father of multitudes. Sarai's name is changed from My Princess, meaning, you know, one person's princess, to a princess, and the implication is over many people. So again, it's signifying God's intent to bring the promised child and ultimately the multitude of children through Abraham's wife and not, for instance, through Hagar, who had, you know, been a character in previous chapters. Jacob is renamed to Israel in Genesis 32, name change from supplanter, who's taking the place of the rightful heir, to a prince contending alongside God, meaning that he is now sort of working with God and has a right to this inheritance. It signifies God's intent to have a personal relationship with Jacob and for Jacob to be the one to carry the promise, to be the heir, the prince. And then last in the list, many hundreds of years later, is Simon having his name changed to Peter. Simon means more or less one who hears, and Peter means a rock. And I think it signifies Christ's intent to turn Simon into a crucial stone, unintended, in the foundation of his church. And we'll talk more about the you know, on this rock I will build my church passage when we get there later in the segment. But I think that's what Jesus is saying to Peter when he changes his name. So what comparisons can you draw from their stories to the future life of Peter? Like, why is Peter added to this list of people whose names are changed to signify God's intent to work in their lives?
Going to be used for a particular purpose for God.
Yeah. Yeah. And what would that purpose be?
Becoming a foundation for the church, for the gospel to be spread later.
Yeah, which is not just an afterthought. The church is not just an afterthought or here's a good idea. That was always God's plan. And like Abraham and Sarah and Israel, God changed Peter's name to show the power of his will to keep his promises about bringing the church into existence. His power to control all things in and out of the world, to do whatever he wants to do in the time that he chooses, to know his creatures intimately, to be able to say to somebody, you know, you've been a rascal your whole life, but now you're going to be a prince contending alongside me. To say to Peter, you've been listening carefully, now I'm going to make you somebody crucial for the success of the plan that I've had from the foundation of the world. And ultimately, in all of these cases, to move people out of their pasts and into a greater future. To become something better than they already are. To realize their full potential by God's grace. And then added to that, I think all of these name changes really are reminders to us that God changes people's names to show the power of his will to create successively more perfect covenants. So when he renames Abraham, Sarah, and Israel, he is looking forward to a new kind of covenant relationship between God and men in the Mosaic Covenant. In Isaiah 62, verse 2, I had it open, but the wind closed my Bible. But Isaiah says that you're going to be given, when you come back from, when you're restored from captivity, you're going to be given a new name, which in the context of the New Testament, we understand to be the name of Christ that God has given to us. And then significantly for each of us, in Revelation 2:17, Christ promises a new name to faithful believers in the new heavens and the new earth. We will each be given a new name. Maybe the name that's talked about in Isaiah 62:2, maybe something different and new that we've never seen before. But that will be the beginning of a new covenant when the new heavens and new earth are realized, and the fact that we will be given a new name, and the fact that we know that that will happen right now, is to us a signal of God's intent to create an even more perfect covenant than the one that we are currently in. And so Peter's name change signals both the coming of the new covenant and Peter's personal transformation. And both of those are the story that we are going to be examining as we look at the life of Peter. It's the story of Peter changing and the world changing because of the church that Peter is instrumental in founding. Any other thoughts about this this idea of God changing people's names? Ken, you're muted.
How about that? Well, did I get it?
Yep.
Okay. In a sense, Christians' names were changed. In the beginning, they were called Jews after the Judah, and then when Christ came in, Christians has a new name.
Yep, that's right. And I think that is a fulfillment of Isaiah 62, too. I think you're exactly right. Yep. So this is something that applies to us just as much as it did to Peter. All right, well, we're at time. We started a minute or two late, and I suspect nobody is rushing off anywhere. So I just want to very quickly run through some early experiences with Jesus in John chapters 2 through 4. So remember the wedding feast at Cana? That's where they go immediately from Bethany beyond the Jordan. Jesus turns the water to wine. I think he's recalling but also surpassing Moses turning the water to blood. That was Moses' first miracle. And Jesus doesn't create blood. He creates wine, and also perhaps Moses providing water from the rock, bringing forth something to drink where there was nothing before, but he surpasses those. But the point is that he manifested his glory. That's what John says in John 2, verse 11, and his disciples believed in him. This was something that Jesus did really very privately, but the disciples saw it, and he manifested his glory to them. So that was critical, I think, in Peter's early experiences with Jesus. Then they go to the Passover in Jerusalem. Jesus cleanses the temple. He prophesies his death and resurrection, very obliquely, I'll say, and nobody seems to have understood what he was saying, which I think was his intent. But he does say it, but when he says, you know, destroy this temple and in 3 days I will rebuild it. And I think this is significant. They saw him, as John says, not entrust himself to them. And I think that means a couple of things. One, Jesus didn't reveal his true plans to be killed and raised. He hinted at it, but he didn't really reveal it until much later. He didn't trust himself to them. He didn't tell them everything that he could have because nobody was ready for it. Not the disciples, certainly not the crowd, and definitely not the rulers. But I think maybe it also means that he did not encourage or allow populist political action. He'll do this again after the feeding of the 5,000, where he knew they were coming to make him a king, and so they escaped to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. I think Jesus is not entrusting himself to them because, again, that's not how it's going to happen, not how this kingdom is going to come about. Then Jesus talks to Nicodemus about the spiritual nature of the kingdom and being born again. Maybe the disciples heard that conversation. It's possible. Don't know for sure, but it happened, and presumably they would have heard about it at some point. And then the conversation with the Samaritan woman at Sychar in John 4. I think this is a really important moment in the early life, in the early discipleship of Peter. It demonstrates how unconventional a disciple's life is going to be. They go to get food. They come back and Jesus is talking to a woman who's a Samaritan. And then she leaves and more Samaritans come and Jesus doesn't want to eat anymore. He wants to talk to them instead. Like, this is craziness. By the way, can you think of another time in Peter's life where he was hungry and some people that he didn't expect to believe in the gospel showed up wanting to hear? I'll raise that as a trivia question. You can think about it, see if there's maybe any parallels. I think this conversation also shows God's intent for non-Jews to be saved, right? These are Samaritans. They're not Gentiles, but still, they're not the people that, you know, are supposed to be part of the Messianic kingdom. And yet, very early on in Jesus' ministry, he is showing the disciples an example of looking for a harvest among non-Jews. So in these early stages, Peter is learning who Jesus is and what it will be like to be his disciple. And I was thinking about it. In some ways, this, I wonder if this is kind of like, if you can remember, like the first week of high school or the first week of college, right? Where it's like you kind of knew what was going on, or at least you pretended to yourself that you did. But everything was new and overwhelming and strange, and who are those people, and what's this metal box that I'm supposed to keep all my books in, and why do I have to walk half a mile to get to my next class, and what, you know, what is going on? I wonder if that's maybe what this early period is like for Peter. You know, it's like, no idea what's going on, but I'm pretty sure this is where I'm supposed to be, and I'm pretty sure this is the right choice for me to have made, but still fairly overwhelming. So after this, this is detailed in your lesson. You can go and look at it. These men apparently went back to their lives, and Jesus kind of had some adventures on his own before he comes back and calls them, which we'll talk about in the next class. So very briefly, let's review our objectives. Can someone explain quickly how Peter met Jesus and found out who he was? Yeah, Andrew introduced him, and what did Jesus do?
Changed his name.
Yeah. Good. Can anybody name three events in Jesus' early public ministry that Peter witnessed? We just flew through all of them, so if you can.
Water to wine, Nicodemus, yeah. Well.
Yep, good. And I also put the resistance to the populist political action, because that becomes more significant later in Jesus' ministry.
So you got John 3 there on this slide, but previously it was John 6:15.
I can't quite hear you. Say that again.
You've got chapter 3 referenced here.
Yes.
And on the previous slide, 6:15.
I lost the end of that. Did somebody hear what he said?
He's saying 6:15 was the reference on the previous slide instead of 3.
Yeah, well, I was just trying to understand the...
Oh, yeah. Because in John 6, that's where Jesus is more explicit about. They came to make him a king, and so he escaped from them. But I think he's doing the same thing here in John... I think I should have put John 2, not John 3. It's the end of chapter 2.
What I mean, so, yeah. John 2 or 3.
It's John 2. So this is where John 2, not 3, is where the first time where Jesus doesn't entrust himself to them. And I think part of what that means is that he didn't let them make him the Messiah in the way they imagined the Messiah operate. He didn't let them kind of make him a king or a figurehead. But John 6 is where it happens again, which is a nice cross reference to let us see that that was something that Jesus had to contend with. And so he may be dealing with it in John 2 as well. But it is John 2 and not John 3. In fact, the one above it is John 2 as well. Anyway. All right. List three of Peter's relatives.
Andrew.
Good. Who else?
Children.
What's his dad's name? Yeah, John or Jonah.
Jonah.
Wife and children who are not named, and his mother-in-law who's also not named. Yep. All right. So next time, we're going to look at the kind of, it's a whole weekend that's recorded for us in the Gospels, which is a really cool it's get to look at 3 days in a row that, that Jesus spent with his disciples and what they learned from that. So I'm looking forward to that lesson. Hope you'll be back for that. Thanks for letting me go a little bit long. Apologize for that. And we'll see you guys on Wednesday.
Thank you, Mason.
Thank you, Matt Mason. Thank you.